Right, as I said in the introductory remarks, we really do have just an awful lot of material to be covering tonight, which is an awful lot of material, not because of the number of pages, but because of the tremendously dramatic and interesting events that take place in chapters 11 through 21. I'm going to start with the setting back, though, on page 274. So as you can see on the screen, it'll be Judges chapter 10, verses 7 through 9, which is in the right-hand column, and it's the last scriptural block that you see there on the page. So there on the bottom right, work your way into the paragraph, verse 7, and it says that the anger of the Lord was hot against Israel, and he sold them into the hands of the Philistines and into the hands of the people of Ammon. From that year, they harassed and oppressed the children of Israel for 18 years. All the children of Israel who were on the other side of the Jordan in the land of the Amorites in Gilead, which is the eastern shore, eastern side of the Jordan River. And then verse 9, moreover, the people of Ammon crossed over the Jordan to fight against Judah also, against Benjamin, and against the house of Ephraim. So that Israel was severely distressed. Well, I guess they were. There are at least four different tribes that are being impacted by these various incursions. And so you've got the Amorites, you've got the Ammonites, you've got roughly the people that are the Gileadites. We look at a map here in just a second. And it's just a terrible, terrible time. For 18 years, they're suffering. And this is the reason for this, it's a sign for this, is that God's anger was what? God's anger was hot. Okay? Now, brethren, I'm sure it's bad enough if God gets mad at you. If God gets mad at anybody, you're in pretty serious trouble. But if God's anger waxes hot, then he's really upset. And this side of God is a side, his just side, his angry side, you know, is a part of his character that we, you know, don't much care for in our day and age. The religious world in which we live is just really constantly emphasizing the love of God, which is right and good, but nearly to the complete exclusion of the righteous justice of a God whose anger is can be measured, you know, on a scale up to a point where you could be suffering horribly for 18 years. Now, these incursions mean that their crops are being stolen, their houses and property are being invaded, people are being killed, people are being raped. This is the times that they're living in. And so we're setting ourselves as Christians today to remember that all nations and repeatedly throughout the scriptures are punished when as a group, as a people, they turn their backs on God. That includes this country, you know, as well. So the lessons that we find here, the New Testament specifically tells us that we as Christians are to learn from these things. So it's most ominous in that setting there. And if you'll skip down page 275 over to verse 17, left-hand column, just before the bottom there where you have the title for Jephthah, just above that. Then the people of Ammon gathered together and encamped in Gilead. And the children of Israel assembled together and encamped in Mizpah. So I realize that I can really overdo it, too, with all these maps. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this, but just to show, here's the Dead Sea, of course, Jericho down here. Jerusalem is just out of sight here to the left. So as you go up the Jordan River here, these lands that have been invaded, is everything here to the east, with various incursions being made as well into Benjamin, and these are the last letters of Judah. So we've just got, you know, problems that are going on. Jephthah will be raised up to solve these problems, and he's going to be involved in quite a number of battles. So you can find any number of atlases who really do get into meticulous detail on these battles. You can study them in surprising graphic ability, at least, as far as the maps go. So all I want to point out here, though, with this particular map, is that Ammon is named as one of their chief antagonists. The Ammonites are living in this area that today is called Jordan. Everything you see on this map is east of the Jordan River is Jordan, the country, today. And remember, the capital city of Jordan today is what?
It is Amman Jordan, A-M-M-A-N, which very obviously is derived all these thousands of years later from these original Ammonite people. They are the descendants of these people and have been living in this territory, you know, since nearly time immemorial. So the very capital city today, which Don and I have seen, and by the way, is ginormous. I forget how many millions of people live there. It's really, really big. Amman is also in the Bible referred to as Rabbah, R-A-B-B-A-H. So you'll see, you know, modern Amman depicted as Rabbah. Somebody had a hand up. There you are.
My statement is not as important as yours, but
that's debatable. How many of you would agree with that proposition?
It makes the verse 16. It makes the remark that the Lord's soul could no longer endure misery. How many of us think of the Lord having a soul? We have a soul that we worry about, but does God?
Well, that's a great point, you know, and it's an expression I think that has to do with the deepest of your emotions is what that's about. And when God's people are suffering, well, first, when God's people are sinful, how do you feel about it?
Angry.
Very angry about it. But then when he visits their punishments upon them, well-deserved, and he sees their suffering, what then? He feels that too, doesn't he? So that hurts him. How many of you have ever actually said, this will hurt you more than it hurts me? Don't ever do that again. Kids will never understand that. Okay. But see, in a sense, it's really quite literally true. God understands every aspect of your life, everything you're going through, and it hurts him, it bothers him. This is not what he wants for us.
So, you know, as far as digging deeper, I think, as you intended, as to the nature of a soul there, I really can't add any more to it. I don't have, you know, additional information about that. I would only say that we are made in God's image. And at the beginning, with Adam and Eve, what did he do? He breathed into them the spirit of life, and his very spirit. So we only live because we are participants, sharers, in the spirit of God. That's what keeps us alive, keeps us animated.
I believe the Ammonites were cousins. Like they were lost descendants, if I remember right.
I think you're right there too. And yeah. You know, already I lose track of all these, you know, relationships.
Yeah,
but are they descendants of Lot? Then is that?
Lost them.
Yeah, we got that history in Genesis and already talked from
it. The question I had is, you know, the Israelites beg God for rescuing, and so he raises up judges and sort of like that, but here God is answering these people in these verses here and saying, well, you know, go visit the gods, I've helped you before, I'm not going to help you anymore. Who's he talking to that gets the message to these people?
Oh.
He must have some kind of spokesman that he works through.
Yeah, that's an excellent question, and I'm presuming at this time that there were very many more judges than the 14 that are named, you know, in the book. And so we don't know, you know, particularly who that may have been, but we are given 14 different names, but it covers a lot of years and more than those 14 men, even if you just listed them one after the other. And so God was very eager to communicate with his people. And up to this point, how many books have they got? You should be able to give me a number. Right now, how many books do they have? They've got five. From Moses and one from Joshua. And we're in the process now of what? Having the history that becomes the book of Judges. So they've got the written laws. They've got the law of Moses. They also have the priests who are supposed to be interpreting those laws for them. And when you have direct communication like that, apparently God is choosing to do it now through these judges / prophets. Anybody that speaks for God is everybody. Anybody who speaks for God is a prophet. Is every prophet a judge? No. But is every judge a prophet? Apparently. They've been contacted by God, raised up by God. He is communicating with them and guiding them, at least, you know, in so far as that's the information we get in the book of Judges. Okay, really appreciate comments, truly do. And so keep them coming. Now, that brings us to Jephthah, though. How many of you were here Sunday night when I preached that lesson on Jephthah? I know it's going to be the great majority of you. There are a few here that weren't able to come. So we took the whole night to discuss Jephthah. It took me about 40 minutes to go through it. You know, he's only named in two chapters, and so it's not that we have a lot of material, but that material is very, very interesting. And tonight I'm only just going to summarize it with the chart that I used on Sunday night. You can go online, thanks to Jerry over here, and hear that lesson if you'd like more detail on it. But just to go very quickly, in chapter 11, which begins on page 275, in the first three verses, we are told, and you can scan that material now while I'm talking, that he's got a really tough childhood. He's being mistreated by his own half-brothers. You know, these are not choices that he made. But, you know, it's a really, you know, tough childhood. In verses 4 through 8, then, he has been driven out, and he becomes, from that information, what I like to dub a cynical warrior. He's learned the hard way how the world works, and he's become rather distrusting of the people that drove him out, which includes not just his family, but also those that were the rulers in Israel at the time, or in that area at the time. So in verses 9 and 10, and again, I'm just asking you to scan. You've read the material. I'm not going to repeat Sunday night, but you know, he's learned to be very, very careful, and so he's questioning these people as to the things that they say, whether or not they're actually going to take place. But he is himself an extremely faithful individual. He is one who turns everything over to God. He spoke all these words in verse 11, before the Lord in Mizpah. Mizpah is the city in which he has become now the chief, where he has his home, and is you know, directly communicating with God with all his questions and his problems. In verses 12 through 28, which again I'm just asking you to scan, you've already read hopefully this week, you see him working with the king of Ammon through messengers, trying to find out, you know, what is your beef here. There's a long argument that takes place there, which again I won't take the time to develop tonight, but he proves himself to be a very wise individual and well-versed in the history of Israel. He knows that book of Joshua, and he knows it a lot better than we do, because this time, you know, it's been passing. Israel not only has this book of Joshua, but they're passing these stories down generation after generation. And so he can recount this history back to this king of Ammon and prove that the man has no claim to the land that he's now invading and trying to take over. In verse 29, we are specifically told, and this will be tremendously important in the next section as we talk about his vow, he is led by the Spirit. That's something we are told immediately preceding this vow. And so, let's not forget that. This is a man who has an unusually close relationship with God. He's a man who's been selected by God to lead these people. He's going to be granted an enormous amount of success, you know, in battle. His character is just faultless. Everything that we are told about this man is just magnificent. God is well pleased with him. And he knows at least his history. I suspect that he knows his Bible. A lot less Bible than you and I would have to know. He's probably quite conversant with it. And then lastly, we have the vow, and we find out that no matter how painful, this is a man, as we will read later, who swears to his own hurt. Now finish the quote. Swears to his own hurt and changes not. Okay? When you take a vow, you make an oath, you promise that you're going to do something, and then you realize that you've really messed up. You have sworn to your own hurt. That is a big mistake. I shouldn't have done that. But then you don't try to change it. You don't try to alter anything. You recognize that that's the contract you entered into. Now, by the way, the last couple of days, I've had to spend several hours in terrible misery because my mom has a renter down in California.
And the renter, in a very emotional manner, in a very unreasonable manner, accosted my brother, literally waving the contract and declaring that it was unfair, and she thought it needed to be rewritten, and she shouldn't have to pay as much, and she shouldn't have to, complete several different things that she had promised that are written into the contract. Mom let her live there because at 84, Mom needs help with the horses. And this woman has decided she didn't want to do that anymore. And she wants to pay less. Well, we've got a contract. The fact is she's already paying way less than market value. And that was because, we wanted her to help with the horses. So now she thinks she's scoring her own hurt. And what does she want? She wants us to change the contract. This is not the way it's supposed to be. This is not Jephthah. Jephthah swore to his own hurt as big as you possibly can, which is going to disrupt horrifically the life of his only child, his beloved daughter, as we'll see in just a moment. So, first though, we have this argument that he makes in these verses in chapter 11 against that king. And then, here's the map again. The war breaks out and they're chasing each other, all over everywhere. But ultimately, how well does Ammon fare against the prophet and judge of Israel? Not very well. So, tough luck. So, Jephthah wins, the other guys lose, and he's now chief over all these Gileadites over there, so things are going really well. But he returns home, and who is it that comes out of the house? Well, it's that daughter. And apparently she is close to, or perhaps just, come to, a marriageable age. And so we get the impression from the context there that apparently she's a teenager. And this is, this is desperate. Now, I went through all this again last Sunday night, so I'm not going to spend a lot of time with it tonight. But if you look at Deuteronomy 12 and chapter 18, that's 12:31 and 18:10-12, those of you on the tape, human sacrifice is forbidden in Scripture. Now, I think Jephthah knew that, and, he's Spirit-led. He's a man that's well-pleasing in the sight of God. He must know that human sacrifice is absolutely forbidden. It's as illegal as anything can get. It is abhorrent to God. It is an abomination to God. It is highly unlikely, brethren, that he would not know there was a possibility that the daughter, he may have been hoping for servants, I don't know what it was, but that, apparently did not think the daughter was going to be the one from what he says. But brethren, he had to know that was a possibility. So already, I think it is highly suspect to think along the lines that he was intending to kill whoever came out of the house. That's something at least we have to take into account that doesn't seem to be much, in harmony with anything else that we know about the man. Now, immediately after the class I taught, the sermon I preached on Sunday night, Bill Kohler came up and caught me good. And so I had to do some more research here, and I just overstated something, but I did go back and look at it. He said, well, Larry, I'm sure there are places where you do have sacrifices that are of female goats or sheep. And I had said that there never is, and that was incorrect. But what I was trying to get at, and what I should have said, is that in Leviticus 1, verses 1 through 3, the first three verses of Leviticus is about, quote, burnt offerings, which Jephthah used the term. When Jephthah used the term, burnt offerings are always and only male and never female. So Bill was right, to call me on it, that there are sacrifices where he could offer a female animal, but not a burnt offering. The burnt offering had to be male. So again, to think in terms of him killing the girl is very problematic, because not only would he be violating one of the absolutely, biggest prohibitions in God's mind, but he would then be, offering a human sacrifice of the wrong gender. Well, now he's committing sin upon sin if this is what he actually does with the girl. Please note also that God accepted his vow and God answered his vow. He gave him exactly what he wanted. He routed the Ammonites everywhere he went.
And so, as God looks at the vow, God is not only well pleased with Jephthah to begin with, but he accepts the vow. So again, I hardly think that if Jephthah was promising a human sacrifice, that God would have been at all pleased with him. Things would have been very different, I think, in that record. Now, I also want to point out, though, that in Leviticus chapter 27, there are provisions for the redemption of a sacrifice as well. So even if he had in his mind that he was going to kill somebody so that God would reward him, then, when it was his daughter, he might have redeemed her. That was a possibility, though we see that he didn't. The big thing to remember, brethren, and if you don't get anything else out of this class tonight, remember this, that in Judges 11, verse 31, there are two ways to translate one of those words. And this, is pivotally important, and I think makes all of the difference, in the world. So, if you'll come over now to page 277, you'll note that in the left-hand column there, and I guess it actually starts, in the middle of the sentence at the very bottom of 276, but it'll be that whatever comes out, so now top of page 275, of the doors of my house to meet me, when I return in peace from the people of Ammon, shall surely be the Lord's. Now mark your Bible. That word can be translated and, but it can also be translated or. Or I will offer it up as a burnt offering. So I'm thinking that there were two possibilities. And bear in mind, again, I've seen this in the Philippines. It's very common. I have been in homes in the Philippines where they don't just have dogs and cats living with them, they have pigs living with them in the house. I've seen it. They have chickens living with them in the house, which is entirely composed of a room that is smaller than any classroom in this building. That's their entire house. And so when you're living in impoverished circumstances, and by the way, they've just spent the last 18 years experiencing what? The pillaging of everything they own by several different invading peoples. Okay, so they've been reduced to living caves, right? So Jephthah's house at this time, has been under assault. So whatever comes out of my house, I'm thinking that the word should be translated or, and that the first thing that came out may have been sheep, lamb. It could have been one of the sacrifices so specifically, meticulously detailed how to offer in the book of Leviticus, which Jephthah must have known. Or, it would be devoted to the Lord, or it would be a burnt offering. Now, this devoted to the Lord idea shall surely be the Lord's, or I'll offer it up as a burnt offering, is reminiscent of Anna in Luke chapter 2 and verse 37, where you have a temple servant then. We only have the tabernacle now, but we have female temple servants. They're not priests, but there are these more mundane chores that they can do, and they're dedicated then to that temple service. I rather think that's what we're talking about here, or a burnt sacrifice if it had been an acceptable animal in God's sacrificial system. Bill?
I think there's a reference also that Eli's sons in the time of Samuel were playing with the women.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, good for you. And again, there's another reference. We know that there were women serving at the tabernacle, and Eli's sons got out of control with some of them and paid the price. They were killed. So when you put all this together, brethren, ultimately, Judges 11:31, I think, is really the key to all of this. But let's not forget that in Judges 11:37, 38, and 39, three times in three adjoining verses. You scan them now. What did the daughter and her friends lament? That she would be childless. Not that she was going to die, but that she would be childless. Now everybody look at 277, left-hand column, and we're going to look at the next to the last paragraph down there, starting with verse 38. So, when she said, you do what you promised, God gave you what you asked for, and I will accept the consequences, he said, go. He sent her away for 2 months. She went with her friends, this is her request, bewailed her virginity on the mountains. It was so at the end of 2 months that she returned to her father. Note very carefully the sentence structure. She returned to her father and he carried out his vow with her, which he had vowed. What do the next 4 words say? It would have only taken 2 to say she died. Okay. But it takes 4 to say what? She remained a virgin to the end of her days. She knew no man. So, brother, there's absolutely no doubt in my mind that we need to disabuse ourselves of the idea that Jephthah was such an honorable man that he kept a vow to violate God in such a manner that it's an abomination in human sacrifice. He would offer a burnt offering that's forbidden to be female, and then this spirit-led man who has just, in the most blasphemous manner possible, you know, offended God, is rewarded for his vow and gets everything he asked for. That's just not possible, brethren. So I know it's real popular. I know that many people among the Lord's people, you know, think that that he killed her. Certainly if you go on the internet, that's probably the prevailing opinion. I myself just do not believe it for a minute. So at least you have that option. Let's consider that she became, you know, a female servant dedicated in her virginity lifelong to tabernacle service at the time. Okay, so enough on all of that. Now, Jephthah then gets crossways with Ephraim, and the one thing about this on page 277 with Judges 12 is that you're probably wondering, what is the deal with these guys? You know, Jephthah, you went off and conquered all these people, and you didn't ask us to go to war. You know, how many people would want to go to war? Well, brother, let's answer the question. See if you can get it. Going to war is a very desirable thing. Why do they feel left out? They're cheated. What are they even cheated out of?
The
game. Spoils and plunder. Thank you, Sandra. See? And so especially they see, you know, you won everywhere you went. And we didn't get any of it. And clearly, if Jephthah can do all of that without them, then he can certainly do it with them. You know? And so if they had just tagged along, they would have had the spoils of war. So it's not stated in the text, but I'm presuming that's what it's all about. And so they're angry with him, and it comes to blows, as a matter of fact, there. So the men of Ephraim, this purple line up here, saying that third time, but you know, they came on down here to the Wadi Farah, and then up into this area here near Zaphon, just above Sukkoth, where Jephthah, you know, defeats them as well. And so what we got, you know, is a period of just awfulness that's going on. The people have descended into sin. The invading armies, you know, making life just consummately miserable. And now they're fighting among themselves as well. And it's into this context now, Jephthah has passed away, that we see Samson get his start. Now, with Samson, everybody, on page 278, you know, if by now you've never heard of the story of Samson, well, you're overdue. Most people have heard the name at some point in their life. And so I hope you did the reading this week. But as you can see, our time's already more than half over, and Samson's thing is just awesome. So we're going to spend some time with it tonight, but you'll be as frustrated as I am, I'm sure, that we can't spend maybe as much as we would like. But something I would like to take note right from the start, I should have thought of this last week, I guess, but as you're reading the life of Samson, ask yourself, how many times does God criticize him? How many times does God say he's a sinner? How many times is God unhappy with him? And the answer is none that I know. And so we need also to just be careful, brethren, and maybe admit that we don't understand the circumstances as well as we should. And maybe some of the things he did, you know, clearly are wrong.
But be careful, because Samson takes a lot of grief sometimes, and I'm not sure he, you know, deserves all of it. To my knowledge, he is never, you know, called out by God for, you know, his sinfulness. And wild as he is, I think that's the term that was used by the uninspired commentators here in the book, through that end, it's a wild life, to say the least. You know, he is constantly said to be Spirit-led, and from the very beginning. So let's just at least recognize that as we go through, that maybe we don't know all the story, maybe circumstances are different at the time, you know, I don't know what, but let's be careful at least not to pass judgments where God never did. Certainly God had the option here, the opportunity, but just didn't do it. So let's start on page 278 with chapter 13, and in verse 1, again, the children of Israel did evil in the sight of the Lord. Well, you'll remember from last week, that cycle. And the Lord delivered them into the hand of the Philistines for how long this time? So 40 years this time. So it's getting worse. And in verse 2, there was a certain man from Zorah of the family of the Danites whose name was Manoah. Wife was barren, had no children, and we're hearing a familiar story now, aren't we? We've had already the miraculous birth of Isaac. Now, I wish I had more time with verse 3. You will have noticed now, and I haven't said any word about it, but already the angel of the Lord has appeared several times. And that angel of the Lord is really a mystery. It's hard to figure out what this is. I'm pretty sure that Jerry Bassett is the only man that really understands the angel of the Lord. Right, Jerry? Some maintain that this is a manifestation of Jesus the Christ. Some will maintain that this is, you know, Gabriel. And I've never been able to resolve it. I can't find any evidence, you know, directly for any of those things. So what is an angel? In its most basic form, what's the term mean?
Messenger.
The messenger of the Lord. This, though, is a unique phrase, and it occurs several times. So the best I can say, with any confidence myself, at this point in my studies, is that this does appear to be some unusually impressive or authoritative individual. Beyond that, I don't know. It is a messenger from God. And this messenger seems to be somehow distinct and even set above the others. But I've never been able to go any farther than that. And so I would defer, and I meant it humorously before, but Jerry, do you have anything you would add to that? Any of the elders, anybody have anything you would add on the angel of the Lord? Bill, you had your hand up. Chapter 13 and 22, everybody?
Yeah,
see, that's why I say distinct. The couple that witnessed this say, we've seen what?
God.
And so there's some sense in which they know this is not a judge. They know this is not a prophet. They know it's an angel because we're told it's an angel. They must have known it's an angel. So it's an angel of God, but for them, it just is God.
Do you know, other places, it refers to appearances like this as having been in the presence of God? And was it Jacob that wrestled with the angel, and said he had wrestled with God and prevailed?
Yep. Got his name changed.
The angel was like the direct messenger of God. He wasn't just a servant, he was somebody special.
That's what I mean. Somehow distinct and apparently set above. Jerry, last chance. You want to add anything to that? Okay. Then I feel really safe. Okay, truly do. It's just it's a conundrum for us. We don't really have any definitive answers here. But, as Bill pointed out, that really impressed Manoah and his wife. So skip on down now to verse 24, which is the very last on page 278, right-hand column. The woman bore a son, called his name Samson. The child grew, and the Lord blessed him. The Spirit of the Lord began to move upon him at Mahanadan between Zorah and Eshtaol. So this is a child that the Lord has blessed
with a miraculous birth in whom we are told has the Spirit moving upon him. Just remember that through all the rest of everything that you see. Now, on pages 279 and 280 in Judges 14:1, Samson went down to Timnah, saw a woman in Timnah, the daughters of the Philistines, went up, told his father and mother, saying, I've seen a woman in Timnah, the daughters of the Philistines, now therefore get her for me as a wife. Now, what would you do if your son came in and made an announcement like that? Get her for me? You know, that's a dysfunctional family. Again, I don't know the circumstances, brethren, and I don't know if this is a colloquial expression, you know, in the Hebrew of antiquity 3,000 years ago that we just don't understand, but it sounds really rude and disrespectful and everything to us. But it's also true that throughout much of the Jews' history, marriages were fill-in-the-blank. Marriages were arranged. And so it's not to say that the kids had no say in the matter, because that's never true. They do. Daughter pitches a fit, says, I am not marrying that guy. It's probably not going to happen. Okay? So don't get the idea that parents were just saying, you know, I don't care for you, and I'm going to make this alliance whether you like it or not. I'm sure that they love their kids as much as we do, and that, you know, there's a lot of interplay going on there. But nonetheless, they did arrange the marriages. You had to have daddy's permission if you were going to marry somebody. And mom and dad did have the power to say, this is who you're going to marry. And the children were, I think, to some extent, at least at certain times, much more in subjection to their parents, which is better than what we have today. Because after all, this was the biggest point I made on Sunday night. Who is the hero of Jephthah's story? It's the daughter. For my money, she eclipses everything Jephthah did. She paid the price, demonstrating her loyalty and love to both her father and to God, whose name she invokes when she says, you know, do to me as you have vowed. And so, at least at this time with Jephthah, and perhaps now with Manoah and his family, you know, the children really were in subjection to a larger degree. They didn't run off to find a justice of the peace in another state, you know, kind of thing, if they were faithful. And so, you know, get her for me. Well, he's decided, you know, he's picked a wife. And then, of course, the answer there in verse 3 is, well, is there no woman among the daughters of your brethren or among all my people that you must go and get a wife from the uncircumcised Philistines? And Samson said to his father, get her for me, for she pleases me well. Well, again, you know, look, I don't have to like what Samson's doing, but as a matter of fact, later we're going to find out something about his relationships with women, and we will specifically be told that God was what? Seeking an occasion through her to address her people. So what we mostly don't know is what God is doing behind the scenes. And this is why I just want everybody to be reluctant to, you know, be dumping all over Samson all the time about how evil he is, because we're specifically told later that God's playing a role in this behind the scenes, and we're not told much. So I don't know a whole lot about this. But now, let's go to 4. His father and mother did not know that it was of the Lord. He was seeking an occasion to move against them. Well, yes, that is the verse I was looking for. All right, so remember that. This is a part of a plan that's larger than what we know. Now, skip down to verse 6. To his surprise, the Spirit of the Lord came mightily upon him. And time and again we hear this about Samson. So he tears this lion apart as he would have torn apart a young goat, though he had nothing in his hand. But he did not tell his father or his mother what he had done. And of course, you know the story. As you skip down to verse 19, which is at the very top of page 280, he makes a riddle out of this, and it's going to cost a whole lot of guys their lives and their clothes. His clothes and everything here. And so, once again, you know, brethren, it just freaks us out. It just freaks us out. And it should. It's a different time, it's a different law, it's a different country, it's different customs. And so, that's the way it was back then. I guess I would cap all this off with a statement
from the book of Acts in chapter 17 that I used to hope some good effect with one of those Seventh-day Adventist preachers a week ago, Tuesday. The times of blank, God blanked. The times of ignorance, God, well, depending on translation, winked at, overlooked. Okay, but now calls all men everywhere to repentance. So, clearly, we're in what God calls the times of ignorance as you're reading the pages of Judges. And in these times of ignorance, there are things that God, you know, was overlooking. And that's God's business and not ours. And if God chooses to overlook it, well, maybe we should too. But in this case, you know, all of this business is unfolding according to a plan of which God is well aware. We may not like it by our lights today. This is unfair. We would even say it's ungodly. Can it possibly be ungodly? No. It is God who's unfolding this whole plan. So, we go through the riddle. We go through all of this, you know, and you know, it's 30 guys are going to die as a result. But God was seeking to accomplish something through all of this. Now, let's call your attention to another map. Show a couple more up here. And you see this one is entitled The Places of Samson's Exploit. This is the Philistine Plain. And that's just exactly what you might think. A lot of beachfront property there. And they're pure white sandy beaches, better than anything that California has to offer. I've seen them. And this Philistine plain, we will have learned, it has five principal cities. The Philistine cities are Gaza. Yes, the same one we talk about today so often. Ashkelon and Ashdod, both of which are occupied to this day. I've been in one of them and flew out of another one, as a matter of fact. And then Ekron up here, which you'll be reading about and already read in Samson's Exploits. Timnah is not one of the five main Philistine cities, but whilst I'm here, there's Timnah in the Sorek Valley, and here is Gath, which is the fifth city. Gaza, Ashkelon, Ashdod on the beach. Ekron and Gath are the five Philistine cities that come up time and time again in Scripture. The Sorek Valley and the Elah Valley, these two little valleys right here, are gorgeous and will be the site not just of Samson's exploits here, but in the Elah Valley, what's going to most famously happen there when we get into David's lifetime? Who was the big bully in David's day? Yeah, that's where Goliath is going to go down. Okay, is in that Valley of Elah. So we'll be coming back to that again. Now, just so you get acclimated again, if this is the Dead Sea, and this is the North Shore, straight across, here's Jerusalem. At this time in your reading, is it called Jerusalem? Jebus. Okay? And then Jericho, of course, where all this started. So Joshua's coming in right through here. They've done all this work in capturing these cities. They've portioned out all the tribal lands. Hundreds of years have gone by. Jephthah said 300 since they'd come into this land. And now we've still got problems. Same problems we've ever had. Why? Sin. Because of sin, there will always be problems. So now, in what is the marked hill country of Judah and Simeon within it, and then over here in this Philistine area, for hundreds of years to come, we're going to have these Philistines just causing all kinds of problems. I realize this was a little more crowded, but I just want to show it to you because it turns it a little bit so it emphasizes the mountains a little bit better. But once again, you can see from the north end of the Dead Sea, straight across, you know, is Jerusalem. Here's the hill country of Judah. And then here's your Elah Valley. There's Timnah. So here's our other valley, Sorek. And then our five cities, Gaza, Ashkelon, Ashdod, Ekron, and Gath. It begins right there.
I really like this particular set of maps that I realize are hard, you know, to project. Enough on all that. Let's go to page 280. page 280 and starting with chapter 15 now. After a while, in the time of wheat harvest, it happened that Samson visited his wife with a young goat. He said, "Let me go into my wife, into her room," but her father would not permit him to go in. Well, that's pretty strange. Well, but if you remember the last verses of chapter 14, look at 14:19, just above it. But what came upon him mightily? Spirit of the Lord's there, whatever's going down. He went down to Ashkelon, killed 30 of their men, took their apparel, gave the changes of clothing to those who had explained the riddle. His anger was aroused, went back up to his father's house. Samson's wife was given to his companion, who had been his best man. Why? Because she's the heifer, isn't she? She's the heifer in the preceding verse. If you had not plowed with my heifer, you would not have solved my riddle. She spilled the beans. She told him the answer. Samson knew it. Made him mad. He turned his back on her. Father said, "Well, I guess that's over. I'm going to give her to another guy." And so he did. Samson changes his mind later. He wants to come back. Uh-oh. Now she's another guy's wife. This is kind of a mess. So skip on down to verses 14 and 15. When he came to Lehi, the Philistines came shouting against him. The Spirit of the Lord came mightily upon him. The ropes that were on his arms became like flax. It burned with fire. The bonds broke loose. He found a fresh jawbone of a donkey, reached out his hand, took it, and killed 1,000 men with it. And said, "With the jawbone of a donkey, heaps upon heaps, with the jawbone of a donkey, I've slain 1,000 men." So they named the place Jawbone Height. We put up a big sign that says Jawbone Height. We would do it. So, you saw the block of information there. It was the Jewish way to name places with names that could be translated and would remind them of key events that had taken place there. So I tell you what, in the history of warfare, how many guys have killed 1,000 enemies with a jawbone?
One.
Okay. And we are told why. What does it take? Spirit-led. Spirit-led. Okay? Everything Samson does is miraculous. Everything Samson does is supernatural. Everything Samson does, God was using to teach his own people and to punish the enemies of God. So then, so you know, when he burned up all the fields by tying the foxes' tails together, there are actual grain fields at harvest time in Ekron. So, 1960s, but real close to Timnah. So, here we are. Now, in the plains of the Philistines, what kind of country is that? That's wheat country. That's oat country. That's barley country. So, yeah, you can have sheep and goats out there and all that, but the sheep and goats do real well on the hillsides, too. And you'll grow this kind of stuff on hillsides, so you keep your sheep and goats up, you know, on the hills. The people in the hill country have a different way of life than the people down in the plains. But from the Mediterranean to the Jordan and beyond, and from Dan to Beersheba, what is Israel's land? Milk and honey, brethren. It is just truly great. So, well worth fighting over. They still are all these years later because it's just a really great place to live. Always has been. Right? Now it brings us to chapter 16. Samson and Delilah. And once again, if you haven't heard about Samson and Delilah, you're out of touch. Everybody knows about them, maybe about 1300 B.C. when this event takes place, but verses 1 through 3 at the bottom of page 280, right-hand column, Samson went to Gaza, one of the Philistine cities, southernmost on the coast, same one we have today. Saw a harlot there, and he went into her. When the Gazites or Gazites were told, "Samson has come here," they surrounded the place and lay in wait for him all night at the gate of the city, quiet all night, saying in the morning, "When it's daylight, we'll kill him." Samson, I don't like that laid low at all. It just, the low is added, and it makes it sound like he's hiding out there. It's not in the original text. Samson lay till midnight. He stayed in bed, prostrate, until midnight. Then he arose, took hold of the doors of the gate of the city, the two gateposts, pulled them up, bar and all, put them on his shoulder, and carried him up to the top of the hill and faces Hebron. Is this the guy you want to mess with? Just really not. So, everywhere he goes, he meets with success. Everywhere he goes, we're being told he's spirit-led. We're being told that God is working through him to accomplish all these various things. And the enemies of God's people are really suffering. Things are going bad. And you know how much I love these pictures and drawings from the 1800s, but here is Gaza way on back in the 1800s. And once again, I just want to keep reminding everybody, notice, you know, flat roofs, notice everything built out of stone. Likely, this is exactly what it had been for the preceding 2,000 years. And so this is, you know, similar at least to the way things would have been in his day. They built cities out of these same materials. These are the only materials that they have in the region there. Okay, so that brings us then to pages 280 and 282. And as I say, you know the whole story of Samson and Delilah. She keeps lying to him, you know, and trying to find out the source of his power. And finally, she nags him to death, and so he caves in. Never underestimate, fill in the blank, power of a woman. Okay, so she just worked him over, and you know, she's persuasive, and so much to his shame, he caves in and he tells her what the source of his power is, and he's giving away a relationship and a covenant that he had made with his God that was, in fact, the source of his power. Now, at this point, I want everybody to look at page 282. And in the lower left-hand corner, do you see the picture there? Okay? Nobody knows how he knocked these pillars over. I'm going to show you a couple photographs here in just a minute, though, that may help us to understand this. And this photograph really is pretty good there, too. If in your mind you have always thought of some of the Roman pillars that you may have seen through the years, and many of which Don and I saw in Israel, which are taller than the peak of this building, and a single stone, magnificent stuff. It's just awesome, you know, to see. Well, that is one way you can make a pillar, and with the power of Rome, they did it. But is that what you think you see in that photograph? Really not. It is as likely that they were building pillars that were made out of individual stones that were maybe only a couple of feet tall. And then you would stack these stones and produce a pillar much more easily than the way the Romans were doing it, which required enormous amounts of manpower and great sledges, you know, or boats and that sort of thing. I remember the map here, but we'll skip over it. We've already been through that, but I'm just going to hop through it now. Here are cities now of Gath and Ekron, Timnah and Ashdod, you know, Thorek Valley, Elah Valley. Here's where all these events are taking place. And on page 282, we're going to start the reading in chapter 16 of verses 25 through 30. I'm going to go over tonight, but I have a lot of announcements. So in 25, it happened when their hearts were merry, they said, call for Samson that he may perform for us. They called for Samson from the prison, and he did. They stationed him between the pillars. Now, he didn't do a top hat, song and dance, and a cane, but they were probably torturing him, is what it means to entertain them. They're torturing him. They're abusing him. Samson said to the lad who held him by the hand, let me feel the pillars which support the temple so that I can lean on them. The temple was full of men and women. All the lords of the Philistines were there, 3,000 men and women on the roof. No, it's not a pitched roof, watching while Samson performed. So somehow they had a structure that allowed them to be able to see him, some sort of arena type thing. Now, I'm going to close the class with these photographs. I really am done, but this is an artist's rendition of what they think the Philistine temple of the time at Tel Kassil, which is north of Tel Aviv, was like. This is at a tel, that is a mound of archaeological rubble, called Kasil, okay, artist rendition. This is the excavation of that actual temple, which is much smaller than the one we're talking about. You can put 3,000 people on it, much smaller. But what do you see right here in the actual archaeological remains of a Philistine temple? You see a part of one of those columns, don't you? And it looks like the pictures you had in the book. It's not 100 feet high. They had stackable, you know, columns there. So he found those columns and he pushed, but he only had to displace one of those rocks. Now here, again, you see an even better picture. Here are two columns. And note how very close together they are. As a matter of fact, I haven't been there, but I believe you would be able to stand there and do what? Put your hands on both sides. Okay? So, whether he got to rock it back and forth, you know, until he got one of them to go, and that's just brought everything down. You know, I don't know how he did it, but let nobody say that this cannot be done. Samson had done an awful lot of things already, and it's not physically impossible if you understand that structure. So there's the Philistine aerial view of the site that we've just been looking at. Okay, but all that is only to say, brethren, never in the history of archaeology has anything ever been found that actually contradicted any Bible statement. And inevitably, when we think it does, all you have to do is dig deeper, and you'll come to light, and you'll realize, you know, that Bible has never made an historical mistake. Ever. Okay? Comments or questions? It's a big one, isn't it? Short reading, 14 pages. Oh, my. Lots covered.